Welcome to the Space Cave. I'm David Huntsberger. Excited for this conversation, which is a continuation or a revisit with a previous guest, someone who has stayed in communication from time to time, which is always nice to get a little check-in, but never to the point of really knowing what each person is up to. I guess I blather along into this microphone enough that you kind of have a general idea of what I'm up to. A new season of These Are Those Tapes just completed. There are new intercepts on the way coming soon. If you haven't signed up over at The Endless Abyss, no need to. If you're a Patreon member, if you support this show, you'll get a membership just by doing that. There's full chats, full episodes in there. So that's another reason to join the Patreon for this show. Listen to uninterrupted chats. But if you're listening to this version, it also has no ads because of contributions from listeners just like you and the Professor Blastoff catalog, which may still be why some of you listen to this show. It started right after Blastoff ended. It became unavailable on Stitcher, and so now there is a way at patreon.com/Professor Blastoff to listen weekly and you can just wait a few years and download them all for a low price, or you can pay per month and kind of relive that experience if you would like to listen to the Blastoff episodes again. There's a whole back thing I get into in the Patreon as to why we're doing it that way, but that was the most reasonable procedure we could come up with to make sure that people could still get access to those episodes. Anyway. My guest, the last time we chatted, I think it was in a boardroom or a conference room underneath the hotel I was staying at in San Francisco, and he biked over and brought some beverages, some libations, and we shared them and had a very nice conversation, and then found out that we have some similarities in our sort of reluctance to fully embrace immersive technology and or just technology that feels like it's taking away that humanness, the connectivity that, body language and or just the way you feel when you're in the presence of an actual human versus likes and thumbs ups and whatever we get used to with those little dopamine things. Didn't have a smartphone for quite a while. Also is a woodworker. And the last time we checked in, he was a carbon cowboy working on the NASA campus. And so this is a fun conversation because I feel like I typically have these with people in arts and entertainment, which is, my career has taken a little bit of a turn I maybe didn't see coming. Here's what I like, don't like, didn't foresee coming, am learning to enjoy, finding out that I enjoy, all of those great things that happen when you make a change in life. So anyway, I hope you're excited. I certainly enjoyed it. Here's part one with the brilliant and talented Yoichi Shiga. The deficit or not detrimental, but just post-pandemic. Yeah, like the calculus of it. Yeah. Like, I think I did 95% of them in person before, which when I think back, it was just such a harder thing to do. But, it's like a muscle you have built up where I'm doing shows or like when you and I met up, that was made way more sense to me. And now
you're doing your show.
Yeah, like it's just changed a lot where everyone's sharing the video all the time and recording more like this. So that's just a residue from the pandemic, but I just can't get into it. I don't know why. I just think the video element is like, why would you need to watch a podcast? That's so bizarre to me.
Well, I think the audio capture from the mic makes a lot of sense. Having some way to facilitate that, because I was thinking on my end, like, how am I supposed to record And I was like also doing like looking up free services and it's the same thing. They're like, log in and sign up and like now you're a member. And I was like, oh, no, I'm sure there's free recording softwares out there. So
yeah, definitely. And then like, you know, I don't know if you listened to the episode with Sharus, but like all the open source stuff and kind of that new platform of software. And I'd been looking into, is there an alternative for like Microsoft Office? And there is. There's like this thing called LibreOffice, and it's just a bunch of developers that are like, we think this should all be free. And so they develop this. And there's a ton of stuff like that. And then I feel like, you know, what does that become as we go forward to like kind of a Web3 world where right now art is kind of valueless to some degree. People can just scroll their phones and like get free entertainment of any sort. And just like all these subscription things we're talking about, it's kind of a teaser. Hey, you want to hear more of that? Go behind this paywall. You know, do that. And I think everyone's trying to figure out like, how does that look going forward? How do you navigate that? All of it.
Yeah. No, even things with, I don't know, I've seen these commercials for Photoshop where they use like generative AI and it's just like you're typing in what you want to see. Yeah. And I was like, I spent like years in school trying to be able to learn actually how to do that manually. And now it's like, okay, you don't have to learn how to do that. You got to pay for the like Adobe subscription, you know?
Yeah. And the things that you spent years in school trying to learn, whether it's Illustrator or Photoshop or all the little, you know, lasso tools and feathering the edges and cutting and pasting. And just, you look back at that, like, that's pretty simple. The magic wand and removing backgrounds and blurring things. And then AI just went, yeah, I mean, you've done that so many times. It's like predictive that now I'm a phone and I can do that. That little bit of software is in there. So then if everything starts to become that, you're like, well, where are those marginal elements that a human is valuable to this equation? If I'm just thinking it and it appears, you picture people like in WALL-E just sitting in chairs like, I'm thinking of this. Can you create that? Ah, that's what I was thinking. Great. Then add this, 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 and this. Put this song under it. Share it. I keep going back to that all the time of these like dystopian projections that seem to be just incrementally getting closer of everyone filming themselves or creating in that way, like, you know, generating AI products, sharing it, hoping for these kind of responses of hearts or thumbs up. And then also giving hearts and thumbs up and just sitting in these little cubes and just that, hearts, hearts, hearts. And then uploading their stuff. Did I get some hearts? And
but I think there is going to be a backlash or like a reset. I feel like that's how generations are, you know? It's like the example in my mind, like the 60s and the 80s, you know, it was like there's like this weird interplay. I think the next generation, and I feel like I've already seen it a little bit, where folks are less online or less into social media. I don't interact as much with those newer gen folks, but there's a couple people that I'm working with who are, yeah, fresh out of college, and there is a range of different types of, I mean, I'm assuming if I was in that generation, I would be one of those backlash people. If like my parents were taking pictures of me and posting it everywhere, yeah, I'd be like, I don't want any of that, you know? And so I think there's going to be pushback. But yeah, I mean, as like a trend, we're definitely moving in that direction.
I don't want to say that's optimistic, but I like to hear it because it makes me feel less alone in that, you know, because if you look online and you feel like that's where everyone is. Sometimes, especially having had kids and we wouldn't maybe hear from people that we would expect to, like, where is everyone? Like, where is, and then you'd look at your phone like, they're all in here. This is where everyone lives and exists. And to think that people would go, or I guess backing up a little. One, I do want to like get into what you're doing now and who you're working with. But two, like, I was having a chat the other day with someone, not on the show, but just in general, of like, pre all this, when people had read A Brave New World or 1984, a million other kind of dystopian, it felt like we were all ready for don't let it get you. Don't let it get its hooks into you where you're just sitting there staring into this void, thumbs just going. Make sure to breathe the air and be a part of this actual world. And it felt like everyone over a certain age was not only ready for that, but ready to implement that to the younger generation to like, let's not raise kids who are just plugged right into the system. And then fast forward to the time we're in now and you're like, that didn't work at all. Everyone was just raring to go to jump right into this augmented reality or virtual reality or just escapism of a phone. And so it is nice, and I will say optimistic, to hear that maybe younger people are examining that and maybe reading those books and or just thinking for themselves and being like, I want to have a little bit more authentic interactions. I want to have genuine, and here we are talking through screens, but like but human body language.
I think
language.
Besides the actual thought of like, okay, we can put value on one of those things or the other, I think generations in general always push back on what people were doing before. So like, because we made such a big leap in one direction, there's always going to be like pushback. I don't know how far it's going to be, but I think that's natural. Even if we went the other direction, you know, if we went like all eco and, you know, the next generation is going to go. And I think that that part of that is happening in our generation a little bit. You know, I think there's all these different segments going in different directions. So
yeah.
Interesting. But yeah, I do want to show the beverage I brought.
Thank you.
Because I wanted to open it because it is a different audio experience.
Oh yeah. Can't wait for this Foley.
Beer can.
Yeah.
Although I'm a little worried because I feel like every time I open it, I spill it. So I brought a napkin.
Okay.
We'll attempt it.
I'll be quiet.
It has these clear instructions that says pull.
It's like an old fashioned like Coors original 1970s pull tab.
Yeah. So we'll see if we can get this.
It wasn't as loud as I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
But it looked like you were struggling. That looks like
I was. I definitely spilled it.
I should have tried to match it. I apologize that I didn't. We were at the grocery store this morning, and I could have. But I'm curious with the ginger beer there. Like, what is the sugar content?
Oh,
I feel
gosh.
Like it's always
it is like through the roof.
It's nuts. Yeah. And I.
It's 40 grams of sugar.
I was like, I can do this. I should
80% of my apparent daily value percentage.
Yeah, and how many servings is in that one bottle?
Just one.
Just one. Oh, okay. Remember for a while they were like putting those labels in then very small print and be like, this is 4 servings. You'd be like, hold on. Who drinks this in fourths? So I apologize. I didn't join you. I have orange juice. Also a high sugar content, but cheers. A mid-morning recording, depending on when people are listening to this. It's not like there's been a clamor to bring the beer back, but I have found that, many people are like you, like, I'm not a big drinker. Like, I don't need to incorporate that into every equation. But I think the impetus for maybe this type of show came from, you know, waiting for a friend to show up somewhere and just getting into a conversation with someone to be like, oh, well, I got to go now. But that was interesting. When you're with a friend or you talk about other things that can be a little more repetitive, and then you meet a stranger and they're more open to talking about ideas and things they're interested in. And and I don't know why I thought
totally.
Just alcohol was helpful in that, but sometimes it does loosen people up a little bit, particularly like scientists who sometimes can be a little reserved.
Well, it's like I feel like a chit chat is different. And now that I'm getting older, I realize with my friends, I feel like there's like probably a German word for this, where like we've had the same conversation. Like, I don't know how, like a year or 9 months will pass and the same exact thing. And we're like, didn't we talk about this like exact topic already? And so now, I mean, I'm obviously not that old, but feel like I'm getting older. I'm realizing now that that cycle has happened like half a dozen times. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay. And it's, I don't know. I'm starting to have more empathy for adults from when I was a kid. And like, there's so many little things where that I think is part of it. But also we went and saw I was telling you, we were going to be in San Diego. We're going to see my niece for her birthday. That I realized as an adult, like I'm doing all the same things that adults said to me when I was a kid. And I realized like, I don't actually have anything interesting. Like, how old are you? What grade are you in? You know, what are you studying? You know, it's like, I don't have anything to contribute, or I don't have the language to actually have a anything more interesting. And I realized when I was younger, like, people kept saying, like, oh, when I saw you last, you were this big, and now you're this big. And it's like, oh, because kids do grow up fast. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it feels funny that I'm repeating all of that now.
I was walking my son up to preschool the other day, talking to a child, and I said, do people ask you all the time, or do people tell you all the time that you're getting bigger? You know, yeah. I'm like, that's adults for you. They just kind of run out of stuff to say. But I love that Mr. Rogers was really good at, and I try to implement this a lot. I think that's like kind of the greatest thing that he left behind as far as a legacy, beyond just exposing kids to learning. But it was his communicative skills, his ability to get down on their level and say things like, I'll bet you have secret ideas. The kid would kind of nod and they go, what do you think about when you hold something like this? Oh, I think of a magical, and then off they go in their imagination. And then if you can just kind of pry that out and they like talking about it, that is the best. And then I feel way less like a prototypical adult. How many, when's your next birthday? What age are you going to, you know, like you just, we fall into that. And I have a friend that was always like, yeah, when I was a kid, all I thought adults did was sit around and talk about the price of meat. And there is there's some truth to that. I was always kind of aware that, like you're saying, you get to certain ages and it felt like these gateways open up. And then every generation or even yearly, people go through those same gates and they ask those same questions. You're 18, you're wondering what your life's going to be like. You and your friends are talking about that. You're talking about adults, the 25-year-old gates, and then talking about, are you having kids? Are you married? Look, can you believe they're doing that? Wow, they did it on purpose. And then 30 gates. And you just keep going through these gates and realizing, like, everyone's just walking through the same amusement park, seeing the same kind of things, and the rides change all the time. They're a little different. Technology is different. Modes of transportation are different. Mm-hmm. But in general, you're just wondering about it. And the saddest one to me is when you have really solid experiences with friends over a course of years, but then life goes on and they move somewhere else. And then when you get together, you just talk about those same experiences and only like five of them stand out. So then you start to go, I'm going to see so-and-so. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about this person. And then we're going to kind of run out of stuff. So you have to keep making those memories with people. But sitting there talking about old memories is not really a new memory.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think maybe building on. Yeah, like building on new. I mean, that's the thing, too. When friends move away, building on new experiences has to be pretty deliberate. You got to like schedule it.
Yeah.
In a way where then you can do those things. But yeah, you'll always have those other, at least I think of it from like kind of college and grad school times, those types of experiences are when you had probably more expansive types of experiences. So they're always going to kind of stand out unless you, yeah, are working on something specific, I think.
Yeah, there's, and some of them have been guests on this show. There's kind of this little LA scientist, science enthusiast sort of group here. And a lot of times they'll arrange travel out excursion type adventures to, we're all going to chip in and go to Costa Rica for a couple weeks. You can hang out with monkeys. You can take photographs. You can just chill. And I think things like that are, you know, what people are, it's, you think of a group of older people that, oh, they've been doing that fishing trip for 30 years. You got to do stuff like that where you have reasons to get together and do just something new. Even if it's sort of the same fishing trip, there's going to be some new thing or some. And I think that in the physical world is a lot different than the digital world, and hard to maintain, hard to do. But if you can, then you feel like your life is always being fulfilled with putting new stuff in, new memories, new experiences, because it. That is not the best feeling to be sitting there going, you and I haven't made new memories in a while. And it doesn't feel so fun.
Yeah, but I think you can't, or I was able, I have one friend who's moved to Minneapolis when, you know, we were friends in Michigan. I moved back to California. And I don't know why, but for whatever reason, we, even though we live in different places, still try to do things together, but separately. So it'll be like, well, we were going to do like a train for a sprint triathlon, and we both picked one in our local areas and tried to train and do it.
Cool.
And then since the pandemic, we also picked up like kind of, okay, I don't really want to call it woodworking because it's beginning to try to woodworking, but like build the same project,
yeah,
in our own respective places. And then we could kind of talk about using the same tools and talk about like how hard and bad it's going or whatever, you know? So, and then get advice or critiques of someone virtually. So I think there are ways to work around that. And I think those types of friendships where I'm like, oh, we're actively doing something, you know, I don't know what the proper term is, like, you know, you're parallelizing the friendship.
Yeah, that's the word I was going to use, is like parallel experience where, and then that's where this current technology is vital, so beneficial that you can share that, you can weigh in. You know, a friend of mine and I years ago trained for a marathon in different cities. Same sort of thing. Hey, how'd your 8 miler go this weekend? How'd your whatever go? Like, oh, man. And then vastly different weather, but the act itself is similar.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much easier in California than in Minneapolis.
No,
I do. He's like, oh, it's snowy, so I can't run.
Yeah. My friend would be like, I was in a hotel and they had this really crummy old treadmill, but I got 6 miles in, and I'd be like, oh, there was this lady going real slow on the boardwalk right as the water was shimmering this golden sunlight off of it. And that was my trouble. I had to go around this lady just briefly. I felt, you know, those are things in life where you're like, what am I even complaining about? But you kind of need that in an experience. What was hard about what you were doing? What can you...
Yeah.
Share with
everybody. Loves complaining.
There's such the camaraderie, the bonds of getting through any difficult thing, whether that's school, whether that's learning something new outside of school, like woodworking. Yeah, like it's not complaining. It's just a shared sort of, it's not even misery. It's just humans don't like to feel dumb. And learning involves feeling a little dumb at times. So then that is one where you can complain about, like, I couldn't figure out, but then I got it. And so that moment, that crest of like, but then I got it, humans love that.
But I do think there is something about if you think of like the bell curve of human experiences, the big chunk of it in the middle, nobody likes talking about that, but it's only the edges, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a preference toward the lower end, like the things that are like, ugh.
Yeah, I have a friend, I mean, it's maybe a little more serious than... the lower end, you know, if you have a bunch of bad things happen, well, how bad are they? Your car gets stolen or crushed, or those things are temporary and they seem awful at the time, but they didn't really get to you. Whereas like if your mental health takes a dip or you lose close friends, those are the ones where you're like, that part of the bell curve stinks. And when we read about them though, people that overcome that, then we're that's what invigorates us or inspires us to be like, oh, they have a really good foundation. They have a really solid approach to life so that they can deal with these sort of difficulties. But yeah, when the ones that are just sort of surface, oh, my car, this happened, then I got kicked out, and then I got fired, and this, like, yeah, those are just life things that you'll get over those.
Yeah, it's true. It's like the virtual bell curve in your brain at any given time isn't the actual bell curve.
Yeah, that's a good way to look
actually,
at it.
And actually, going back to losing things, I still remember when your bikes... You lost your bikes. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. Man, I think
and I could totally relate. I remember you posted about that, and I was just like searching Craigslist, like, let's find these bikes.
Thanks, man.
Because I had that experience, and I remember it was just like so, like, it was such a violating, like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, I think about them all the time. And then on one hand, I'm like, I wasn't riding all the bikes all the time. I sort of had them. So when we had visitors, when we had people come visit, we had bikes ready. Mm. And I had built, like, every part. I mean, one of them, the elastomers inside the forks. I ended up finding some old vintage ones, like, on eBay. But I was learning how to pour and mold that sort of composite material to build my own elastomers. They were like hand machined, the seat post clamp. My friend made it in a machine shop. I sent him all the specs. There was just like very specific things to those bikes, but that's just life. And the thing that grinds me the most is not that I lost them. It's that I have, you know, it was during the pandemic, it was a rough time, and I was like working kind of out, and we had this little driveway at the time and this little side gate. And I would think, I'm going to leave that unlocked. Not open, just unlocked, because I want to be able to trust this world that I live in just a little. I mean, I've lived in this neighborhood long enough. Can I leave for an hour and leave this gate unlocked? And this, I don't know if I've shared this part. I leave for an hour, maybe 90 minutes max. And when I come back, there's this little kid's bike up at the end of our driveway, and it's leaning against some trash cans. And I'm like, huh, the neighbors must have seen that we're pregnant, and they like quietly brought over a bike for like a 10-year-old. But still, what a nice gesture. And I go up and the grips are all filthy, like someone has been riding it and sweating and they're gross. And I'm like, well, that's not the greatest gift, but I can change those grips. And then, you know, seeing that void, like walking into the garage and just something's, your brain first goes, something's, like that feeling, miserable. And that's just one of those bell curve ones where like, just, you know, the memories of however you attained a bike, someone you love gave it to you, so you saved up a bunch of money, you worked really hard, you might remember all those hours doing whatever job, but then when you physically build it, you remember all that. There's just, if you have something invested in a bike, love for the person that gave it to you, that your time and effort, then it was, yeah, that was really challenging. But, you know, I've moved on from it since then, but people ask me about it all the time. Like, did you ever find those bikes? Like, ugh. No, I did not. I'm so sad about it, but so it goes.
Yeah, I had two bikes that were, well, one bike was cut to get to the other bike. I had two bikes locked to each other, and one was locked to like a secure thing. And so essentially lost both bikes because I couldn't put the other bike back together. Like cut the diagonal piece. So
that at least they didn't ruin it.
But then I didn't really learn. Because I put my new bike in that same location. It was like behind a gate in an apartment complex, so you could hop the gate.
Yeah.
And someone had just hopped the gate. And I don't know how much longer, but I got a new bike. It was, you know, a used bike, but I had it parked out there. And I came down one day, and some guy was like disassembling the bike.
No!
And I was like, what are you doing, dude? This is my bike. And this probably just goes to show, like, my nature, but like, I just asked him to put it back together. And I stood there. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought that this was an abandoned bike. I was like, no, that's mine. I was like, did you steal those other two bikes that were here? And he's like, no, I swear that wasn't me. I don't know. It probably was that guy. But still, I was like, he put it back together. But he knew his way around bikes.
I bet when you tell people that story, maybe it's just a male thing. Did you crush him? Did you beat him up? And we came home one time, same place, same not so great neighborhood, and there was someone taking the screens off of our windows. And I'm like, I have a little baby in the back seat at the time, and then I'm like, you know, like my partner next to me, and so I'm like, stay here. I get my phone out, and this person comes out from behind, like in the bushes on the side of the house, having just removed a screen. But they were wearing like one shoe, they're filthy, really emaciated, dirty. So immediately your brain's like running through all these things. Is this fear? Is this anger? Should I pummel this person? You're jeopardizing my family. And people are like, did you crush him? And I'm like, immediately when I see this person, I'm like, this person has taken enough beatings in their life. This person has had a rough go. And so I'm like, what are you doing? And the guy's like, oh, I work for the water department. So I'm like, well, I thought you might. I got to get a photo of you. So I have this photo of this guy just flipping me off in one shoe. And then I go, you got to get out of here. And then he's scared of me. He's like, can you move so I can walk past you? And I'm like, yeah, fine. So the police come and they're fingerprinting the windowsills and all this. They never find him. I mean, and they were so lazy about it. I had kind of followed him along because I just wanted him to get to a place where he was like off our streets. So he wasn't trying to get into people's homes. And a couple weeks later, he's back out in front of our house, like going through one of our bins that was on the street. But I just walked down and just started asking him like if he was on medication or if he needed anything. And I'm like calling facilities. Like, what does it take to get someone some help? There's nothing. They're like, oh, you can against their will drive them 45 minutes away. And that was really disappointing. So the bike thing, similar to, you know, like the humanity that's there is weird because you're like,
yeah, there isn't really a next step when you're in that situation, or at least because I've been in a similar. I remember somebody threw, I think it was actually like a part of a lighter. Basically, they threw something at our apartment building and it made this huge explosion.
Whoa.
So I was like freaked out. I look outside, there's a guy, you know, like, what am I supposed to do? I called the cops, they come by, they grab him, they're like, do you want to press charges? I was like, well, no, like, I don't know. But like, what do you, like your initial reaction? I realized like when I played it all the way out, I was like, oh, I guess it's just a crappy situation, and it's not like the police can do anything.
Yeah. No, I've started thinking that, like, the need for mental help and, you know, I know there's a lot of language around, like, defunding police departments, but redistributing or reorganizing or having some form of available mental health, which seems like it could be a nightmare if you're a volunteer, but little boutique corner stores or vacant properties in any crappy neighborhood, what if we took those and just a community service to everyone chipped in and, like, just a person sitting there you could go in and talk with and make the connections to get the right treatment or help. You could bring your friend, hey, my friend needs some help. Can they sit here and talk with you? I think that's a little altruistic, but in calling in a gigantic city with a tremendous homeless problem, trying to figure out what resources are here. I mean, I would see that dude. One time he was standing in our neighbor across the way. I think they were selling their house. They weren't there a lot, but their water was on. He was holding their hose. There was no gate, so he had just walked into their driveway, and he was holding their hose and just spraying the driveway back and forth, concrete, just watering this concrete. And I knew his name by that point. I go, hey, Alex.
Water department, though.
Yeah, water department. God, I was so sad. At one point when I was asking about the medication, he pulled out this notebook, and it was all these spirally kind of strange, almost like, you know, one of those shape creator things you'd give kids, you know, a spirogram kind of thing. They look kind of like that. And he goes, does this mean anything to you? And I go, just looks like some drawing, man. I do you see something in there? And he goes, it's hard to explain. It's kind of like another dimension or time or something. And I go, do you hear people? He goes, no, I don't hear people. I was kind of like, well, what's going on? Like, why are you here? And he's like, the pandemic, I lost my job. And then, you know, my wife, I just kind of spiraled out. And I'm like, but do you need help? He's like, no, I'm okay. So flash forward, I see him, the water department, out in this driveway. And I go, hey, Alex, what are you doing, buddy? And he goes, nothing, my own business, something like that. And I go, if they come back, I don't think they're going to love it. And you might get in trouble, just so you know. And he goes, okay. He's like, listen, he goes, I just got to finish up here. And then I go, are you doing okay? And he goes, yeah. Are you doing okay? Yeah, I'm all right. It made no dent in his life. It didn't help him or anything, but I always felt like maybe just to be seen, maybe just someone at least pretending to care.
I guess I don't know. I don't know what that experience is, but I feel like personally, I typically don't interact or don't engage. And so I feel like just that engagement, just that interaction, which for us is something that's very normal, that happens all the time, is probably meaningful. It's probably different, a different way to respond. And I think that's, I don't know, it takes kind of guts. Like, I wouldn't do that, you know, necessarily.
I wouldn't recommend. I mean, I was bigger than him, and I'd probably ascertain that his physical health wasn't, maybe anyone can channel some, like, animal-like energy and flip out and be a detriment or, you know, a harm or a something scary. But I wouldn't recommend it. At the same time, I'm like, isn't that how everyone gets there? They just get ignored by everyone. They get not seen, not talked to, and then... So as a community, as a society, it was kind of like this experiment with all of that. But anyway.
Yeah, I think most people are lucky because they don't have to interact with that. My wife works at a county hospital, like the, you know, I don't know what they have. They have a term, sort of like hospital of last resort, where everybody goes to. Mm-hmm. And so she sees those people all the time, every day.
Oh, man.
And for me, it's only when you're like walking through a tough neighborhood. And so like I'm more tensed up where... She's like, well, this is like what I see at work. So,
everyone has their own. I know when I like was substitute teaching and I'd have long-term gigs. I'd be the teacher for like a whole semester. And sometimes I'd start like after school programs and stuff. And I just had a better view of how things is just like people just need more time committed to them. And everyone I ran into had their 2 cents about like, well, the school district and this much money and this. Everyone had their thoughts as to what would make it better. And I'd always be like, do you volunteer any of your time? Well, no, like that's probably a part of it. We're all just so busy doing other stuff that people get, for lack of a better term, just like kind of let slip through the cracks. And then we're like, what are you doing down there? Get out of those cracks. You should be penalized. Yeah. Like, I think it's been bad enough already. Not to get too far in the weeds that way. Anyway,
Yeah.
A little, we'll pour, we can't pour out our drinks, but a little tip of the cap to our bikes. Maybe we learn something about loss along the way. And if those are the worst type of losses you have in a life, what a life. Because that, you know, they're just bikes. It's hard to deal with at the time. But as time goes on, you're like, eh, hopefully someone's using them. Or I just hope that frame's okay. I feel so bad that yours was damaged. I mean, if someone had cut my frame... I can tell you the whole story of like buying that frame and the weirdo I got it from. And like, I love a story. I love a thing that has we found this out in the weeds and we fixed it up. That's my thing. So that was one of those bikes. But hopefully it's somewhere safe and sound and someone's riding it around. But where are you working these days? When I emailed the chat, or you emailed me, bless your heart, you were like, hey, one of the episodes has some funky audio, which if you're listening right now and you just muscled through that, do like Yoichi did and reach out and say, hey, there was a little glitch in exporting, which I never would have caught. Because once I've exported it, I'm kind of like, it's good. I've run it through the filters and it's good. You caught that and messaged me. And then here we are recording. But you had said, oh, there's a lot to catch up on. A lot has changed. And last time you were living near San Francisco, you were working like kind of on the Stanford campus. Is that right? Or like... the NASA
thing. I had to look back and see where I was at. I think I must have just started my, I was working at NASA, but not for NASA.
Okay, yeah.
That was what I'd say. I was like a contractor, visiting scientist, but working at NASA Ames. Yeah, big change. I have like career change since
whoa.
Then.
Because
I
last
wrote
time
down
it was
three
like,
things
okay.
on my notebook. I said,
cool.
Inverse modeling. That's what I used to do. I could always talk more about that. Fascinating stuff.
Well, the way
career
we
change,
we
the big thing that shifted.
Okay. Yeah. I, not that I want to go part by or interrupt you too much part by part, but what I remember the inverse modeling was kind of ink had gotten into a swimming pool, and that was sort of the carbon footprint that had been left by certain things, and trying to kind of quantify that and figure out what's getting into where. And what I thought was so interesting was that you weren't really, this show a lot of times can, not that it gets too bleak, but just talking about climate change and views on humanity, you didn't seem that interested in that beyond just, I just want to figure out like where all this stuff is going. And then maybe once we have that quantified, we can figure out what we could potentially do to change it or offset it.
Yeah. And so the third bullet point is sort of impacts and climate change, like you know my thoughts on that, and I have sort of three different arenas of where people I think can contribute or but yeah, at the time that was what I was focused on.
And so the career change
in the moment.
Yeah, well, what is the new career and what prompted the change? I suppose that's where I would start.
Yeah, I'd say what prompted the change, I'll start there, because the position at or the contracting position was like, I don't know, more like freelance, and so I had to bring in the money to fund essentially my own research. And so like the long and short of it is like I didn't get any more funding. And so like it became to like a, you know, I had like a turning point, like am I still going? And it was also kind of you know, had like the lens of the pandemic. So basically I think I was 6 months into that position when the pandemic sort of lockdown happened, and then I did like another year of this like scrounging for funds and looking for or applying for grants, doing a bunch of work doing that, still doing research, but then looking for money. And so I think it came to this point, and actually it was funny because there was a previous guest of yours, I think, had this quote where it was like, repetition is like safety or security, and like variation or variability is freedom. And so I feel like I had been in this realm of like variability for so long. And then like the pandemic happened. I think my like shift was like towards something more secure.
Mm.
And so like, I think that was the big push. And I actually had a very I don't know, cast a very wide net. So like, I was like super open to doing anything at that point. I was like, I want something that's more secure. I was like, like part number one, but also like I have pretty varied interests and pretty varied skills. And so it was actually pretty hard to even just get out of the mindset of like academia and research and like carbon cycle and inverse modeling. And so I did a data science boot camp, which I don't know, folks in academia, I think it was like a trend of some of my peers did. So basically it's like an 8-week program where they try and like learn, or they try and teach you like real world skills, like how to actually be a data scientist, how to do some programming for industry rather than just like research. And so I did that and completed that. And I have a funny story about cutting my finger, which actually like allowed me to get into this program. But after that, I honestly didn't really, I was like just applying for anything. And I had a friend. So like where I end up, I think is very weird from where I began. So that's why I'm building into it.
Yeah, well, I'm so basically now, you just teased out this finger cut, but I'm so curious how that led to, I mean, very few stories involve, I nicked my fingernail and yada, yada, yada. Now I own this company. Like, wait, what?
So basically for these data science boot camps, you have to have a project, like a capstone project. And you kind of actually have to come into it with the project. And so the finger cut, which happened during the pandemic, was I got a new gardening tool and I nicked my finger. I sliced it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that bad. But to me, I realized like I'm not good with blood in this moment. And I felt like, oh God, I'm going to pass out. I texted my wife, you know, like I cut my finger really bad. She works at a hospital. So she's like, well, just take a picture of it and I'll show it to people. And I was like, I can't like even get like let go of the pressure. It's bleeding so much. It's so bad. And so for better or worse, I just like waited, put pressure on it. I think I might have sent a picture. They're just like, well, the rules are if it doesn't stop bleeding after a certain amount of time, go to the ER, go to urgent care. I live like a couple blocks from a hospital. So I just ended up waiting 4 hours. It was still bleeding. I go there. You know, they admit me. It's still during a pandemic, so people are all worried. And so it felt kind of like stressful. You know, they check me in, the person looks at it, they're like, oh, this? Yeah, whatever. We just put a little, like, did you clean it? And I was like, well, yeah, I washed it. And they're like, oh, and it had by then, of course, like kind of stopped bleeding.
Yeah.
And so they put some glue on it, sent me home. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's it. And then like afterwards, Kristen, my wife, came home, she was like, that was it? And I was like, you said you cut your finger really bad. I thought it was like dangling.
No. Like, I don't know. Oh, man.
So that's the whole buildup. But what allowed me to build the sort of a project that had anything to do with data science was that I got the bill from the hospital and it wasn't in network. And it was like $1,200 for going in for like 2 minutes, getting some glue. And I was just kind of blown away. Like it wasn't going to break the bank for me, but like that just seemed absurd. And I had no idea. It's not like I could ask them ahead of time. There's no prices anywhere. And so I started, of course, like being, I don't know, me. I started digging into like, well, how come hospitals can just charge you for stuff and they don't have any menu essentially?
Yeah.
And I guess in California there is a new law that said, or there was a new law back then, that all hospitals have to post all their prices. There's a form that they have to fill. It has to be accessible on their website. Of course, it's like impossible to find.
Yeah.
And so the tool I built was like gathered all that information and put it on kind of like a, you know, like a Yelp site, you know, where you could like type in your destination or type in your location and it'd, you could pick from one of the standard services and it would tell you the price that's listed on those websites. And so that was the project I built for this boot camp.
So it would be almost like at one point I had this idea for a ticketing app where say you and your partner, some friends, visitors, whoever wanted to go do something and you had sort of a budget in mind, you could enter that and it would show you a map, all these venues and ticket prices of what you could see. Oh, we can see this play for this amount. We can go see this band for this amount, a comedian here for this amount. And then you'd enter it and either get them or not get them. And the idea being to just facilitate tickets going to things that, you know, they would all have to sign up. Like, we struggle with this venue, but it being sort of what's the cost barrier? You could, ow, I cut my finger. The idea being you could look up an app and be like, hey, it's only $40 over here. I'm gonna take a car over there, but the one that's two blocks away, I could walk to it. But $1,200, I'm not doing that. That's the idea. You could just scroll through and find what suited your budget.
Yeah. And so it wasn't for every single service, because I think, I was just lazy. I didn't want to go through every single entry that every hospital listed. So I think they have to list their like top 25, and it's like, you know, a blood panel or something like that. But yeah, it's exactly, it's still up. It's only for California. I'll send you the link afterwards. I can't remember where it is, but yeah, it was interesting. And it's old data now. I think it's from 2020 in it. So I'm sure there's updated data, but yeah. So that was like the project that got me into this program, and it helped. I mean, again, I don't know, you've had other academics on your show, and I think there's this common feel, or even within this group at this boot camp, like, I have no useful skills for the real world, even though like I have a PhD. They're like, you know, like the thread wasn't like, what job was I going to get? It was like, people are like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get a job, like the other cohort.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a weird mental framework that happens, I think, when you're in academia. I think because you're around people who are such experts, and so you like think the threshold for being able to do something is much higher. So
first part, I believe it was Casey Handmer who worked at JPL, and the, you know, staying in the thing that's comfortable, and then he started Terraform Industries. New, exciting.
That guy sounds incredible.
I feel like he'll be a public figure fairly soon. And I mean, the way his brain works is so fascinating to me and fun to talk to and like to get exposed to. I mean, I feel like this show just in general, everyone I talk to, I'm just like, man, this is going back to like communication between adults and how boring it can feel at times. And well, it was kind of a mist the other day. Yeah, it was almost a drizzle. Like, I just want to jump out of whatever room I'm in. I can't take this. We're only going to be alive for so long. I can't talk about daylight savings. I've experienced it so many times. I can't talk about that extra hour. I don't care. And so being able to do these conversations, you know, it's a spectrum. Like, a lot of people I can relate to, which is great. And other times there are people like, that is a brain that is so different than mine. And the way he can like remember like minutia data in a way, like, oh, in 1825, it was 0.25% of this, you know, and you're like, I read that same plaque. I barely remember like what was happening about any of it. But we all do that. We walk through exhibits and nod and so this statue was built an hour later, eating lunch. Like, what'd that statue say? What'd the plate on it say? And you're like, I don't know. I think it had to do with some dedication after a war. I mean, our brains are wired up to kind of like go through the motions. And so to be very engaged and present, I'm envious of that, to be like, take all that data in and try to store it somewhere and also be able to cite it and, you know, recover it. Very fascinating to me.
Yeah. Super interesting. And actually, I shouldn't be so self-deprecating, but you know, like on the web, a lot of times they'll show like, here's the professional version of some like fancy cake, you know, it's like posted online, and then like, here's my homemade version, and it's like someone trying to recreate it. I feel like I'm the homemade version of this Casey Handmer. Like, he went from like NASA to like creating some terraforming, like climate change solving thing. And I was like, oh, well, I used to kind of work in academia, and then I now work in corporate sustainability.
That sounds like you're being like hard on yourself. I think it's, I mean, in dealing in the creative arts, it's weird. This is like the first parallel I've really latched onto with academia, in the sense that feeling of like, is the thing I create, does it have any value? Like, where do I fit in? I feel like I'm suited to do this thing and I really like doing it, whether that's stand up or like writing my little sketch podcast, but scrambling around and like trying to find funding and trying to like, it feels kind of selfish. You're like, am I just doing this for me? I feel like there would be some value in this. And that's the belief you have to have in any company of like, I think people need roofs on their houses. But you might scramble around and tell people that, and they're like, nah, I've thatched it myself. It's fine. And like, but I think I have an idea for something a little different. Maybe it's more efficient. Maybe you don't even know you need it. That mm-hmm. is a hard thing to believe in. If there's, you need some data to come back to show you, like, hey, that roof is working, and more people like it. I talked to someone recently who had a PhD, and I go, oh, they kept referencing their PhD when I was studying, when I was getting my PhD. And to me, I'm always interested, like, well, what was it? What'd you get it in? And they go, German. And mm-hmm. I was kind of like, the language? I go, yeah. I'm like, so do you teach? And they're like, no. And there's not that many jobs outside of that for it. And which I'm thinking, yeah, everyone knows that. Like, I think 15-year-olds know that. I bet everyone along your process were like, are you sure? I mean, I have a friend whose partner has this PhD in a field that, I mean, she's just never finding work. And if you were told what it is, you'd be like, yeah, I can see where that it's great to have all that education, but how are you going to apply that? And I think, especially if you were, you know, thinking toward the next generation, what if you were a speaker somewhere, what would you tell them? Find the thing you're really mm-hmm. interested in, that you feel like you are passionate about, that maybe not everyone can do, and how can you add value to that? Find a way to like that create value. So that could be a vocational school, trade school. That could just be like, maybe you're in, you know, going to like be a barber or a work at a salon. That's a skill. That's something with your hands. If you know, like, I like doing that, then just find a way to do it. But I feel like sometimes academia, you get, it can carry you along. And you're just kind of floating in this boat, like, I think it's going to go somewhere. I think there's going to be this end point. It'll open up to this beautiful lagoon. But then you kind of get there and you're just, there's no current. You're just sitting in this boat. Like, I came a long way down this stream. Where do I go? So now you're in the paddle phase. You're having to paddle toward yeah. this other thing.
And I think when I started, at least, I wasn't thinking, like, what am I going to actually do? And I think that's like, or I mean, maybe not all people who are younger post sort of undergrad, it's like, oh, here's an experience, let's do it, here's something that I'm super interested in that sounds cool. I realized, like, I think I picked my like undergrad and like PhD just by like things that sounded cool. I was like, aerospace engineering undergrad, I was like, that sounds pretty cool.
it definitely does.
Yeah, I think I wasn't like thinking like long term, like, what do I actually want to do? And I think that's like where the whole like safety versus variation, you know, like repetition, like, I realize, oh, okay, it's pretty stressful, like, just like life, you know. And yeah. it's kind of, I'm realizing, like, what do I want to do, and how do I want to live to be happier, essentially. And so even though those things were super interesting, they were hard for me, you know, to do as like a life kind of career thing. And a lot of the people who are in academia, I think you had someone else who I don't know, it was like a botanist, but yeah, like, you know, you kind of have to move all over the place. And so like, that just like, wasn't the thing that I wanted to, like, the things that accompany that type of career, I hadn't really thought through. And so like, after I, all those things, like, balanced them all together, I was like, okay, maybe I don't actually want to do that as a career. I still love that stuff and love doing it. And it was super interesting. But yeah, now I'm like, trying something else. And I think I'm lucky enough to like be able to kind of do that, because I know some people, they're like, oh yeah, they don't necessarily either think that that's like okay to do, or like feel like they have something that they want to pursue that's similarly like interesting to them. So maybe I'm easily interested in other things.
Oh man, this is exciting, because this feels like, last time we talked, it was all about what you were doing and learning, which is kind of a nuts and bolts sort of, here's what I do, here's this exchange. And now it feels like there's a little bit more of an existential equation to it, which is fun to talk about. So if you're ever taking a little break, I'd love to dive into that.
Sure.
Part 2 coming out soon. And if you're a Patreon person, you've already listened to the entire thing. Why would you be listening again? Perhaps to hear some music. That could be. Like I mentioned, Intercepts is coming soon. I know this show keeps taking these peaks and valleys. I really apologize for that. It's not for lack of trying, certainly just time considerations, and I want to be able to put the right amount of effort into it. But I find that when I have free time these days, it's really time-consuming to edit sketches, and I really enjoy doing Intercepts, and I want to get the next batch of that out. That has been somewhat detrimental, plus scheduling and everything else. So you can help. If you have a guest in mind or a topic, reach out, put us in touch. Pings@thespacecave.com. You can message me, dave@davidhunsberger.com. If you have a type of beer or a song that you like, share it. I'm happy to involve it in this show. And that being said, here's some music. I know that's why you tuned in. You're already a Patreon member, but you wanted to listen to this part just for some music. This is a song by Warpaint. It's called Common Blue. I hope you like it. See you next time for part two with Yoi Tsuchiya.
What rises up?